From the land of Grand University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 19th day of August 2016. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Scott Irwin will be here to talk about last Friday's objective ear weight and what it really means going forward. You're not going to like what he has to say, but you probably ought to stick around and listen to that. He and Daryl Good wrote an article for the Farm Doc Daily website. And then at the end of the first half hour, we'll discuss the weather forecast with Eric Snodgrass. He's at Agrible. If you can stick around for the second half hour, Commodity Week's coming up. Matt Bennett, Kirk Kimmel, and Wayne Nelson will join us on our panel discussion about the commodity markets right here on this Friday afternoon edition of Illinois Public Media's Agricultural Programming.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Here's the way the numbers finished up in Chicago on this Friday afternoon. At the CME Group, September corn futures at 334 and a quarter were up 2 1/4 today. December at 343 and 3/4, a penny and 3/4 higher. The March contract at 353 and a half, up 1 3/4. May, a penny and a half higher at 360 and a quarter. And July corn at 366 and 3/4, up 1 1/4 cents. September soybeans at 1027, down 5 1/4. November, a dime lower at $10.04 and a half cents. And January futures in the bean pit up nine, or rather down 9 1/2 cents at $10.05. The March at $10.25, 7 1/2 lower. May down 5 3/4. July down a nickel. August down 5 1/2. Next year's November down a penny at 9.46 1/4. Bean oil 5 cents lower at 34.14. The bean meal at 3.30. Even, that's down $4.40. Soft red winter wheat, September unchanged at 427. July 485 and a half, up 2 1/2. September hard red at 418 3/4, down 2 1/4. July there at 479 3/4, a penny and 3/4 lower. Live cattle futures in the August contract 2 1/2 cents lower at 113.55. October at 110.25, down 32 1/2 cents. Feeder cattle finished the August at $146.75 per 100 pounds. $1 and a nickel higher. September up 70 cents at $143.85. Lean hogs on the day. October contract $1.22 and a half higher at $61.92 and a half. December there at $57.45, $1 even higher. You're listening to the Closing Market Report, a production of Illinois Public Media. You may find us online at willag.org. That's willag.org. There we post most of our agricultural programming, plus some extras in their entirety. That's at willag.org. You're listening to the Closing Market Report on this Friday afternoon. We're now joined by Mike Zuzulo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting in Atchison, Kansas. Hi, how are you, Mike?
Great to be with you, Todd. Happy Friday to you.
Hey, tell me a little bit about the marketplace and the trade today.
Yeah, we had a cattle on feed report just posted. I'll give you the numbers real quick. 102% on feed as of August 1. That was on the top end of the trade estimates. Placements 102 in July. That was about in the middle of the range, a little bit higher than the middle of the range. And marketings in July, probably the most disappointing to the trade if I had to guess, coming in at 99%. Average trade guess 99.7, low number was 98.5, high number was a little over 103. So I would say fat cattle price negative on the surface, but I would guess that a lot of this is already dialed in, already priced in, given the 2 to 2.5% losses this week. I would also note cash fats in the southern plains are at 118 level, same as last week. So we seem to have found a bottom there. August fat cattle futures traded below 113 today. So there's a $5 discount already built up in futures versus a lead month fat. So I would call it mostly neutral, but maybe an initial negative reaction in the fat cattle market.
Anything else in the livestock we ought to discuss before we move on to the grains?
There is an African flu bug going around in Russia right now, and that normally maybe wouldn't be as big a deal in the trade, Todd, but with China taking an increasing amount of imported pork meat right now and a lot of that coming from Denmark and other parts of Europe, that's something to really watch. I think the hog market caught wind of that today when a couple fresh reports came out. All of a sudden, we went from only up 60 to closing up about double that, about 137 points in the October hogs. So be watching that here in the next week or so.
the most important item for the week for you as it relates to the grains and oil seeds?
I think the most important item is demand held us up this week. We were able to stay up almost 12 cents in the Dees corn, over 20 cents higher in the Nove beans, and a little over a nickel higher in the Dees wheat. But now, in the short term, it's up to supply. We, I think, need some lower yield numbers from Pro Farmer to help settle kind of the disagreement that's going on out there since the USDA yield number reports came out, whether the outside Corn Belt states, and I don't mean this in any slight to anyone, of Kansas, South Dakota, and Ohio, and maybe Indiana, offset what the trade is expecting to be a better than 2014 yield in the three I states in Minnesota. Nebraska is probably the biggest one on my radar because that's where I see the biggest disagreement. Follow that with Ohio, where USDA's got 10 bushels better. I just don't see it based upon the colleagues I work with and the clients I work with over there. So corn especially, we need a lower yield number next week, I think, to offset short-term technicals and support this strong demand.
All right. And then as you talk to producers, what are you telling them?
I think the big thing I did this week was I put out a process flow chart for them to keep in their truck, keep on their smartphone. If USDA goes below a certain yield number in September, what do you do? If the price action goes below the 10-day moving averages in Dees corn of 336 and in Nove beans of 996, what do you do? I think essentially, Todd, what I'm trying to point out to them is the higher the beans go now, the more you want to make room for corn by forward contracting beans off the combine. I think it'll be better to buy back beans on paper than it will be to hold them in the bin, given the wheat stocks, corn stocks, and bean stocks that we'll probably have this year.
What are they most concerned about?
I think probably cleaning out their bins of new crop wheat, and whether we can get back to the 350, 360 area in the Dees corn to be able to make some sales. I think many clients and producers right now would probably like to make another 20 or 25% cash sale at a higher level. You know, 20, 25 cents higher would be wonderful, but even 15 to 20 cents higher, they'd probably snap at it.
As you take a look at the world marketplace, are you concerned at all about crude oil, about other things that have been happening, what's been up with Brexit, those sorts of things?
No, and I'm glad you brought that up. I'm glad we had time for that real shortly here. I think the outside markets continue to outperform, and I think what's going on, especially with the Federal Reserve minutes coming out at midweek, that they are probably more likely to take too long unwinding unconventional monetary policy, and that will cause inflation. I don't think they'd mind a little bit more inflation. And I noticed in the earnings reports from BHP, the big miner in the world, Nestle, the big food maker and food processor in the world, and even John Deere today in their earnings numbers, all have a more upbeat and optimistic tone going forward. Nestle is actually going to be pushing through price increases, and they've already started in Russia and Brazil. So two of the key emerging markets that we've been worried about, it actually sounds like they are improving. And so outside markets in the medium term outlook for commodities, I think, continues to gradually improve, and the investors are buying emerging markets again, and they're not jumping into China first. They're actually buying emerging markets like Latin America again. So nice to have a little bit of diversification. So maybe short term a little bit more negative. Medium term, I think we're improving steadily.
And as you are looking forward into the crop year, we've been talking a lot about what producers might be able to do in terms of marketing corn, soybeans, storing, and or selling across the scale. Do you have a preference of one crop over the other?
Well, right now I have not been impressed with the corn basis. Given the break we've had in futures, given the uncertainty in the yield, I have not been impressed with the way the basis has gone. It's gone the wrong direction, if you ask me, especially for late July, early August. And why would that be? I think it's because we are seeing some old crop corn move. And if that's the case, I think there's better times ahead in the cash basis market for the corn. So that's probably the biggest reason why I would say the higher we go in the soybeans, the better the corn would be to store, not just from a futures and yield standpoint, and USDA may be being too high, but also from a standpoint of this basis needs to, I think, come in 10 to 15 cents in the central part of the country.
You know, a couple of things on the world marketplace, both out of South America. They'll be getting ready for their new crop as we harvest the crop here in the United States. I'm wondering what you think about acreage there and acreage mix there, and how long the lack of a crop from their 2016 will hold up exports for you, the United States.
Yeah, and I think that export question I'll deal with last. I think we hit that really well on the commodity week last time I was on. I think you've got the biggest numbers probably dialed in, especially for soybeans. Actually, China actually sold some beans out of their state reserves this week, and 21% of them sold. And so I was surprised to see China actually letting go and auctioning some reserves of soybeans. So I think the demand side from South America is probably baked into the cake mostly, and that's why we need the supply to come down in the shorter term. The other question, I think it goes back to Argentina probably will go after more corn. Brazil, I think, wants to go after more corn just because of the prices that they're at compared to soybeans. But in Brazil, the soybeans are a currency. And I really wonder what the producers will end up doing down there, given the fact that La Nina is coming, and that typically is not a good crop environment for their winter crops down there. So I've actually been contacting a couple South American clients and colleagues down there, talking to them more about this. And I think everything's pretty much on the table, even though the price of corn is leaning them towards more corn acres.
Anything else that we ought to be taking a look at across the board in this marketplace at this point?
I'd say the one thing that came out this week that was very welcome news was the API, American Petroleum Institute, came out with U.S. crude oil demand in July, hitting a new record. And, you know, you go back a few years, and when we talked about crude oil demand and gasoline demand, we thought we'd never get this high again. So very nice to see that we had a brand new high in crude oil demand in July here in the United States, and that those low prices are carrying the low prices.
All right. Hey, thanks so much. We appreciate you taking the time with us today.
We did a lot. Nice job, Todd.
Well, we're busy and working all the time. I appreciate it much.
Have a great weekend.
You too, man. That is Mike Zuzulo. He's with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Joins us on this Friday afternoon edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. If you can stay with us for the second half hour, please do so. Commodity Week is coming up next. On that program, our guest will include Matt Bennett of Bennett Consulting out of Windsor, Illinois, and Channel Seeds there, along with Kurt Kimmel. He's with Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois, and Dwayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana. Commodity Week, it's our weekly look at what happened in the world of agriculture next week. Remember, as you heard from Mike, that the folks at Pro Farmer will be out on their crop tour, and we will bring you an update each and every day. They're out Monday through Thursday, and then Friday, their final analysis. The Pro Farmer crop tour across the Midwest is next week. You can hear all about it during the Closing Market Report each and every business day next week, right here on Illinois Public Media's Closing Market Report from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Don't forget, in the next half hour, Commodity Week comes up. Our panelists this week included Matt Bennett of Bennett Consulting, Channel Seeds out of Windsor, Illinois, Kurt Kimmel of Bates Commodities from Normal, Illinois, and Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana. If you can't stick around, no worries. It's already up on the website again at willag.org. Last week on Friday, when the United States Department of Agriculture released the first crop progress report of the year for the month of August, one of the items that took the market by surprise for corn was the implied, at this point, to some extent, I suppose, objective as well, weight for the ear of corn. Here to explain how USDA comes to that and what it might really mean over time is Scott Irwin, agricultural economist here on campus. Thanks, Scott, for being with us. I bet this was a toil of either trouble or love,
maybe obsession. Obsessed with USDA crop reports.
Yeah. So, how do they come up with this number for ear weight, especially at this time of year?
Right. It'll take a little bit of time, hopefully not too much boring detail. Basically, what the USDA does is they have what are called 10 objective yield states. These are the 10 states where they actually send enumerators out to plots in fields to measure yield potential using the same kind of calculations that everybody else does who goes out and does yield checks. They just do it in a lot more places and in a randomized set of fields in these 10 big producing states. So in these 10 big producing objective yield states, they will get an average population in their plots. And then they will also get an average ear count, which is typically a little lower than the population for the obvious reasons. And so we get that from those objective yield enumerations. Everybody understands that. So that's what's basically in the denominator of this calculation. Now, then what the USDA does, there's the tricky part. The USDA has two major yield indications. One is the objective yield in these 10 states. That's based on counting ears, measuring ear length, number of rows, and then making some assumption about weight per kernel. And you can, and based on that assumption, they will project an objective yield forecast for those 10 objective yield states. Most people then see the ear weight. It was roughly 0.362 or 0.363 pounds per ear, the number that caught everybody's attention, by far a big weight. And they say, okay, that's what the USDA assumed in their objective yield counts. And that's logical. That would make sense. It's computed on the objective yield states. You count the ears. You project a weight. And that gives you a yield. But that's not what the implied ear weight measure is done. What they do is they stick with the objective yield ear count. That's what goes in the denominator. But what's in the top part of the equation, the numerator, is the published yield for those 10 objective states averaged. And that published yield is roughly an average of their yield counts, which are based on an assumed ear weight at this point, and the farm operator yields in those 10 objective yield states. They're roughly equally weighted. And we don't know what ear weights farmers were assuming. So when you see that big number, 0.363, Daryl and I call it, it's a hybrid. It's a hybrid because it reflects in one component what the USDA assumed for ear weights, plus whatever farmers were assuming but not reported for the yields in those states that they submitted to the USDA.
All right, so here's the important part, I think. Everybody looked at it and said, no way, got to come down. And ear populations were lower than they have been for a couple of years as well, so this 175 yield just cannot possibly be there. Do you look at the numbers, and what did they tell you?
Well, after that lengthy explanation, we went back and just simply collected the ear weight, implied ear weight estimates that were published by the USDA in parallel with the official crop production estimates for 2011 through 2015, and said, you know, is there any precedent in the available history of data that we have for that ear weight to take a big dive, which is what it's going to take in order to move that USDA number down, you know, maybe closer to what the pre-report expectations of around 170, 171.
Right now, every farmer out there is saying it will.
The history says it won't. It really did surprise me, Todd. There is some variability in the implied ear weight from month to month in USDA reports. But if the historical patterns hold, you wouldn't, you know, there's actually a greater chance that it will increase than it is to decrease.
Well, there's one to put in your pipe and smoke, I
suppose. And so I think the lesson that I get out of all this, Todd, is that, you know, once the USDA measures ear weight, they don't move much because in general, their August estimates, particularly since 2012, have been pretty darn good. My guess is that A, on the objective yield side, they measured pretty good ear size. Now, they still have to project weight per kernel, but I think they're finding big ears in their objective yields. And my guess is that's also what is influencing what the farmers are saying in their responses to the USDA. Or somebody's really going to be wrong. But history says they haven't been wrong by too much in the past.
Written version by you and Daryl Good and some graphics up on Farm Doc Daily already?
That's right. We put up an article yesterday on ear weights, and it explains, like I said, everything you could possibly want to know about ear weight calculations, but we're afraid to ask.
Maybe more so now than they were before. Thank you so much. Scott Irwin is an agricultural economist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. He and Daryl Good penned an article for the Farm Doc Daily website. It's there now. Go visit farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. In just a couple minutes, we'll be back. We'll talk about the agricultural weather forecast with Eric Snodgrass. He's from Agrible right here in town.
Well, Todd, over the last week, the rainfall around the United States has just been epic in some places. Now, we've been talking about this incredible flooding that's been happening in Louisiana, where they've got over 2 feet of rain. That's forced the rescue of over 30,000 people. And I just want to put this in perspective for us, okay? In 2005, Hurricane Katrina made landfall in New Orleans and hit Louisiana and Mississippi. When Hurricane Katrina made landfall, she did most of her damage with storm surge. But also, the Hurricane Katrina produced a lot of flooding from heavy rains. This is how much rain fell from Katrina, about 12 to 15 inches. The flooding we just saw that was not from a hurricane in Louisiana was over 2 feet of rain. So it's amazing how being that close to the Gulf of Mexico can produce such amazing storm totals out of these precipitation systems. Now, let's look a little farther to the north. We've had a lot of localized storms last night. Some of them caused some flooding around Kankakee and then another round late last night around Champaign-Urbana. But it was earlier in this week that we saw the major rains come through. So this was the setup. We had a large ridge, a large high-pressure system that was sitting over the southeastern United States. And the clockwise flow around that high brought a lot of tropical moisture right up through the mid-Mississippi River Valley, causing that flooding in Louisiana first, but also dumping a lot of rain in parts of Illinois, Missouri, Indiana, and Ohio. Ohio desperately needed it. But southern Illinois, which received over 5 inches of rain in spots, well, that was quite a bit of precipitation to take in. And then remember, Springfield also got hit earlier in the week last week with over 5.5 inches of rain. So this was a lot of precipitation coming through in mid-August. The good news is, that rain was very timely, and it's going to help the bean crop finish very, very well. So, a lot of rain, but could be end up having a really good benefit. Now, the big story for this weekend, though, is this cool down that's coming. We're expecting highs in the 70s next week, with lows in the 50s around here. So why is this happening? Well, over the last week or so, we've had a large ridge in the jet stream set up over the Bering Sea. And yes, the weather half a world away, this is in Alaska, this is near Alaska, right? Really has an impact on what happens in our weather because it sets up what we call a wave train. It sets up the flow of the jet stream. And that sets things up where there's a ridge over that part of the Bering Sea, a trough out in kind of the eastern Pacific, then a ridge over the western United States, and then a broad trough over the eastern United States. And as that trough settles in, it does two things. Knocks our temperatures back, and also keeps us wet. We're not really expecting to see any slowdown in the precipitation for the next couple of weeks. So here's what we're looking at for Saturday. big chance for some rain and storms around here. Sunday, front comes through, knocks the temperatures back into the 70s. Hopefully that's going to feel really nice. But remember, even though I say it's going to be getting cool, don't worry at all about a frost. Our climatological average date for a frost is October 20th, and the earliest we've ever had a frost was on September 16th. That was in 1916, though, so quite a long time ago. So you can clearly see here that we have a long ways to go before we have to start worrying about temperatures that are getting below freezing. Now, I want to talk a little bit about Brazil, because Brazil's becoming a bigger part of the picture as we get into this time of the year. One of the big changes that we're seeing is that the La Nina that we're forecasting to continue to evolve right now and then really take shape later on this fall and winter, well, the latest model projections are showing it not coming in as strongly as it had. Now, El Nino and La Nina, they do have an impact on crops across the United States, but not nearly as big of an impact as it does on the crops in Brazil. When there is typically a La Nina, it dries out the southern growing regions in Brazil and keeps the northern growing regions more wet. So typically, La Nina events lower the yield potential, like in 2011. However, with the weak La Nina, those signals are not as strong. And we're starting to see some evidence that the upcoming crop coming out of Brazil could be very close to their trend, very close to average for them. Given that they plant more acreage every year, maybe 3-4% more acreage every year, we could be seeing a big crop coming out of South America. So we got to turn our attention that direction about this time of year as they get ready to plant south of the equator.